Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, January 10, 2017. South Sudan hires professionals to monitor the quality of its import and exports.
Most of these are goods that are expired from their country of origin. They just send it to us here. They look at us as a dumping ground that they can bring anything, any bad thing. We really need that the qualities that are to be brought here should be fine.
And traders in Imatong State call on state officials to strengthen security and lift a travel ban on major roads.
They want to take their goods to Torit, but now nowhere. And even the civil servant, they have salary there in Torit. So to bring it here is a problem.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has contracted a private company, Baltic Control, to test the quality of imports and exports. Ministry of Commerce officials signed a deal today with the Baltic Control, which is an internationally recognized surveying and inspection company. Some South Sudanese welcomed the move, saying it will protect consumers from poor quality or expired imported products. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
Although South Sudan set up a National Food and Drug Authority as well as a National Bureau of Standards after declaring independence in 2011, the government has been unable to control imports largely because it lacks facilities to satisfy the quality of consumable goods. Civil society activists and consumers worry that tons of expired food commodities and fake drugs have made their way into the country over the past several years. Juba resident Salah Agri says there is no question that some of the goods imported into South Sudan are of poor quality.
You find that most of these goods that are expired from their country of origin, they just send it to us here. They look at us as a dumping ground that they can bring anything, any bad thing. We really need that the qualities that are to be brought here should be fine. When you look at the drinks, most of the drinks, you find even the gas, it's not there. You just drink it because you want to take, like soda, beer, and so forth. Even the foodie stuff that are brought, most of them are not clean. The qualities are not to the standard that human beings are supposed to take.
Agri says the government must ensure that it checks the quality of goods imported into South Sudan directly from the port of entry so that South Sudanese have peace of mind that they are consuming quality products. Mahjib Adam is a trader in Juba and imports his items from neighboring Uganda. He acknowledges that sometimes the items he imports are expired.
Now it's 2017, so that's a lot of things is going to be finished on 2016. That's like January, it's going to be finished. But now it's 2017, so there's still coming. We have like soaps, we have like biscuits on like beef, salt, we have like anything like that.
Last year, authorities in Awil town seized and burned large quantities of spoiled food items in the market. In 2015, South Sudan's National Bureau of Standards seized tons of consumer goods at the Nimle border crossing through the South Sudan's main entry point from East Africa. To monitor the quality of imports, the South Sudan Bureau of Standards and the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Investment contracted with the Baltic Control Company Limited. Kawaja Zuber is chairman of Baltic Control Company in Africa and Asia. He says the new initiative will facilitate trade in various sector. Zuber says his workers will check all international shipped cargo or trucks coming to South Sudan and will issue certificate of conformity to ensure that the products are safe.
If the consignment has already arrived, and if it is not according to the requirements which you have paid for, then you are stuck with it. So this program will benefit the traders that whatever they have paid for, the quality is actually coming like that. So the CBCA, which is the short form of the program name, Consignment Based Conformity Assessment Program, CBCA, provides the user country with a degree of assurance that products entering its domestic market comply with either national or international standards.
Zuber says the Consignment Based Conformity Assessment Program is designed to protect the consumer from using substandard and counterfeit products and to improve the environment.
Physical verification is conducted in order to ensure that the products being shipped are those for which test reports have been submitted. It should be the actual product which has been tested that should be shipped.
Stephen Doctor, the Undersecretary in the Trade, Industry and Investment Ministry, who also serves as the South Sudan Director for External Trade, says the government contracted with Boltech because it wants to ensure that its imports are safe.
This is a pre-consignment, pre-shipment abroad, and there will be our eyes abroad. There will be our partners abroad. And the idea is all this is to take care of all our products, that to make sure all the consignment for Southern Sudan, for our taxpayers, for our consumers, must be safely consigned and must not be harmful.
A memorandum of understanding was signed 3 months ago between the government and Boltech Control Limited. Boltech employees begin testing and certifying products tomorrow. Details of the agreement were not released, such as how much South Sudan is paying Boltech Control for services rendered. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Residents of Magui County in Imatong State are complaining about a recent ban on travel along the Torit-Juba and the Torit-Magui roads. The Imatong State government banned travel on the two roads following several killings by unknown gunmen over the last few months. Residents of Magui say the travel ban means they are not able to transport food items, including potatoes, cassava and maize, to markets in Torit and Juba. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Torit.
Local authorities and residents in Magui County say their area has been peaceful since the start of the new year, but they argued that though there is relative calm in Magui town, farmers and business people are unable to transport their goods to the markets in Torit and Juba since the travel ban was imposed by state officials late last week. Magui resident Lagu Joseph says the situation became even more frightening after unidentified gunmen killed two businessmen near Aru Junction carrying agricultural produce from Magui to Juba on Sunday. Since the ban went into effect on Friday, Lagu says traders traveling between Magui and Torit are finding it difficult and costly to operate in the area.
They want to take their goods to Torit, but now nowhere. And even a civil servant, they have salary there in Torit, so to bring it here is a problem.
Joseph is calling on the armed men to stop attacking cars on the roads.
We have interest of going to Torit, but now nowhere, so we need them also to leave the road free so that the community there in Torit also should get what is here in Magui.
Ochola Ogeno is another Magui resident who worries about the safety of the roads.
They fear the movement from here to Torit. Well, even yesterday when I was moving from town, there were some vehicles packed with some goods. They wanted to travel to Torit. They did not go.
Magui County Commissioner Ben Kingston Loduk says the area has been relatively peaceful since December. He says residents are still too afraid to travel along the Magui Torit and Torit Juba roads.
We experienced a problem on Sunday where one of the driver who was, ferrying, this food commodity was killed together with a border man. Their possession, like money, was also taken.
Loduk says life would be easier for farmers if they could access the Magui Torit road.
As I'm speaking, there are no movement, between Torit Magui, except few motorbikes.
For the past 3 days, since state officials banned travel along the two roads, no trucks carrying food or other consumer goods have arrived in Torit. The commodity prices continue to rise. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
A new lawsuit in a U.S. court is reawakening a century-old mass slaughter of Namibia's Herero and Nama peoples by German colonial forces, an event that has been described as the 20th century's first genocide. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
When Vikki Rekoro was a boy in what is now Namibia, his family would gather around a fire and tell stories. They were stories of horror and humiliation, of unarmed women and children killed by German soldiers, of terrified families driven into the searing desert to die of thirst, and of concentration camps, whose gruesome indignities would be repeated on new victims in Germany and Poland decades later.
Untold suffering, misery, and brutalities. When we sat around the bonfire at night, this is where the oral history would be passed on from generation to generation. And that's where it came to know about, what happened to our ancestors.
Rikoro is 62 and the elected paramount chief of the Herero people, who number about 400,000. Between 1904 and 1908, tens of thousands of indigenous Herero and Nama people were killed by German troops after they revolted against colonial rule. More than a century later, Rikoro is leading a charge to sue the German government in U.S. District Court in New York, seeking an apology and group reparations. Germany has not issued a formal apology for this dark episode, but the issue has been discussed between the two governments for at least a decade, with no resolution. Rikoro says if Germany does not allow Nama and Herero representatives to participate in talks, there will be consequences. He threatened a public relations and diplomatic offensive, and says his group will lobby to have Germany labeled a war criminal and a pariah state.
We are not going to sit here 100 years for another 120 years and allow an imperialist type of situation to continue to deprive us as Africans of our rights. No, no, no.
Germany's position on the apology and negotiations remains unclear. The German Foreign Ministry did not immediately respond to VOA's request for comment. But 2 years ago, the Foreign Minister said, "We think the time has come to intensify and formalize this exchange between the governments of our two countries." That has not happened, says German human rights activist Christian Kopp, who says Germany should apologize and offer reparations, but he feels many Germans do not agree.
I think Germany would be divided. There are some, and I wouldn't say it's the majority, maybe 50%, maybe even less, who would feel better after this. And there are others, and there are many, many people who say, well, why is it always the Germans who have to ask for forgiveness? So there will be many Germans who will not be happy about this.
Rikoro's lawyer, New York-based Ken McCallion, says the damages cannot be understated.
They went from being a very successful and relatively prosperous indigenous people to really grinding poverty, and that stain has really continued to today. In addition to that, there were cultural losses. In eradicating the people, the German authorities really were also seeking to eradicate their history and culture.
Rikoro stressed that he is not seeking individual payouts for all living descendants. Instead, he wants reparations that benefit the entire community. And he says he feels a deep responsibility to keep agitating. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, will Africa achieve the UN's Sustainable Development Goals by 2030? We'll have an answer for you when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the best advice you would give to a child?
The best advice I can give to a child, more especially here in Africa, is that we need to work hard in class and we need to be focused on our future, what we can be after finishing our education.
Best advice I would give is to follow each and everything that the guardian advises him or her.
I think to be disciplined and try to work as hard as possible in his education, and even be very practical, actually, because what we are living in today, people will get very a long way forward when they are very practical.
working hard, being persistent, yes. Because the way Uganda is at this point, we have to work hard. We have to be so persistent on what we like.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we're talking about liver cancer. Scientists are investigating new ways of treating people with liver cancer. The methods range from developing an artificial liver to seeing if genetically modified pigs can produce organs compatible with humans. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on yet another approach being taken at the University of Missouri.
For those who have liver cancer, their only cure lies in a liver transplant or removal of the cancerous part of the organ. Both require major surgery, and patients who get a transplant will need to take immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives. However, scientists are working on a new approach that is minimally invasive. With both chemotherapy and radiation, healthy cells around the tumor are damaged. But this approach involves the use of natural, non-toxic chemical compounds from plants. Katesh Kati, a professor at the University of Missouri School of Medicine, led a study that used nanotechnology to target and destroy precancerous tumor cells in the livers of mice and in vitro human cells.
It sounds like a fairy tale, but we are really in advanced stages in terms of tumor treatment, in terms of disease diagnostics.
Kati's work involved very small particles of gold encapsulated in a protective stabilizer from an acacia tree. The particles attract precancerous and malignant cells, which are far more susceptible to lower levels of heat than healthy cells.
The patient would be administered with these nanoparticles. Within a couple of hours, the patient would be treated with lasers, and then the patient can go home. So there is no radioactivity, there is no toxic waste, there is no systemic toxicity to the patient.
Kati says the cost of treatment will be low because 1 gram of gold can be used to treat 50 patients. And what's more, Kati says this type of treatment could be used for other types of cancer, for arthritis and other debilitating diseases. The next step is a clinical trial in humans. Should this technique work, it will be good news for the nearly 800,000 people who are diagnosed with liver cancer each year, and it could help save the lives of some 700,000 people who die each year from the disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
We now turn to Gambia, where President Yahya Jammeh's option to stay in office may be shrinking. Ricky Shreok has the details from Dakar.
The 5 judges from Nigeria and Sierra Leone needed to constitute the Gambian Supreme Court did not come to Banjul for Tuesday's scheduled hearing. The session was called to weigh in on President Jammeh's request to nullify December's election results. The international community has already recognized President-elect Adama Barrow as the winner and called on Jammeh to step down. The head of Gambia's Bar Association says the hearing has been rescheduled for next Monday. There has been no confirmation from the judges that they will show up for that date, which comes just 3 days before Barrow's inauguration. 3 West African presidents are expected in the Gambian capital Wednesday to continue the mediation efforts led by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. Buhari Special Advisor Femi Edesina told VOA's Daybreak Africa that diplomacy remains the best course of action, although the West African bloc ECOWAS has not ruled out military force.
This is not interfering. This is rather mediating and peacemaking, because it's a potential. What you have on ground is like sitting on gunpowder, on a keg of gunpowder that can explode at any time. And innocent people will be affected. So it's better to work for peace by talking to President Jammeh, and that is what ECOWAS is doing.
Jammeh's allies are dwindling. This week, the Minister of Information resigned and fled to neighboring Senegal, and Jammeh fired 12 ambassadors who had spoken in favor of transition. Steve Coburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa, says the defections could give ECOWAS some strength in negotiations.
Civil society groups that you would never have thought would dare speak out like that before and are now doing so and have done so, even the Dentists Association. So I think bit by bit, there is a growing isolation. But the key thing that everyone is looking at is how much the army and the heads of the army remain with the president. There will certainly, I'm sure, be some divisions in that. But at the moment, the head of the army does seem to be staying close to Jammeh. And I think that's probably where people will be looking at for movement.
In a statement Tuesday on Twitter, President-elect Barrow said ECOWAS leaders are coming Wednesday to, in his words, persuade Jammeh to step down for the last time. Ricky Shryock for VOA News in Dakar.
The target date to achieve the UN Sustainable Development Goals is 2030. But a think tank says while African countries will make progress towards those goals, they will not meet the deadline. The assessment was made at a recent joint conference of the South African Institute for Security Studies and the British Defence Ministry. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports from Washington.
Analysts say a realistic timetable for African countries to fully achieve the Sustainable Development Goals is 2045 or 2050. Yaki Sillier, chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Institute for Security Studies, says before the 2007-2008 global recession, African countries were growing rapidly. Since then, they're following what he calls a low-growth pathway.
So Africa should be growing if we want to really reduce poverty and inequality and increase employment. Africa needs to grow at 7% and above in terms of average growth rates and maintain that year on year. We do not believe that Africa is going to reach those growth rates. Africa is growing. Around 4% on average is our forecast out to about 2030, 2035.
Sylvia says while 4% may sound like a decent growth rate, it's not enough to bring the needed economic changes.
With those kind of growth rates and with the high levels of inequality that we have, we don't see that increases in income are trickling down to the poorest. So Africa grows for some, and you have a growing middle class, a small, very small upper class that are doing fairly well, but a large component of Africa, those people that are what we refer to as extremely poor, that actual number does not decline. The number actually steadily increases over time.
The extremely poor, about 37% of Africans, live on less than $1.20 per day. Sillier says besides high rates of inequality, Africa must address a rapidly growing population.
There is a large growing worker population in Africa, but they have to feed many kids. They have to look at increasing number of elderly people. This means that Africa is not getting the benefit of a larger worker age population. That is the age of population from 15 to 64. It means that we really need significant growth rates. Remember that China, which had the most amazing experience in terms of lifting, I think it's something like 400 million Chinese out of extreme poverty, did that by growing more than 10% a year.
He says that growth rate lasted for about 30 years. But China is one country, even if it does have a population of 1 billion. Africa is diverse. It has about a billion people, spread over 54 countries.
One of the advantages that China has at low levels of income is that of being an authoritarian state. At low levels of development, an authoritarian government can deliver high, more effective growth and more effective delivery of services than a democracy. But as you go up the income curve, it becomes more difficult. And at medium to high levels of income, a lack of inclusion becomes a drag on growth.
The Institute for Security Studies analyst says this is where rich countries have an advantage over China, which has an authoritarian government. Wealthy nations are usually democracies, with income and education levels contributing to economic growth. Sylvia says that's a good model for Africa.
The vast majority of authoritarian countries in Africa have disastrous growth records. China and countries like Ethiopia and Rwanda have remarkable development-orientated authoritarian governments. Many African countries have none of this. But hopefully over time, democracy will translate into higher levels of growth and more sustainable growth.
Cilia says for African countries to grow more rapidly, they need governments to focus on development. This includes manufacturing and an agricultural revolution that allows Africans to feed themselves.
The most important step for Africa beyond getting its agriculture, small holding, small scale agriculture going, which is different from subsistence agriculture, is to build a manufacturing and industrialization process. And this is not happening in Africa. We are all going into the services economy, and that does not provide the glue that holds your agricultural and your services sector together. All of this is premised on governance, on the quality of governance, and forward-looking government investment in infrastructure, health, and education. But there are no magic shortcuts to this.
What's more, Cilia says stronger democracies are needed in Africa to boost economic growth and achieve the Sustainable Development Goals.
What Africa has is very often not real democracy. We go through the motions of elections. We go to the polls, but governing parties in most instances manipulate the process. So what Africa really needs is free, fair, and competitive elections. In most African countries, with rare exception, that is not the case. The majority of African countries go through, I wouldn't call it a sham democracy, but it is going through the motions of multipartyism, but it doesn't really give you the benefit of democracy. So very important to get those basics right.
He says over time, democracy and development are about institutionalization, moving away from the strongman rule that passes power from one family member to another. He says voters in a true democracy want their voices heard.
They want a greater say over their own lives and to determine the lives of their children. That is very much the story in Africa.
There are 17 Sustainable Development Goals. The Institute for Security Studies says attaining them in Africa will be uneven, also because some are more easily reached than others, like low-hanging fruit. But it says uneven progress is still progress. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That report by Joe DiCapua brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Stop à la guerre by Fally Ipupa.
Stop à la guerre, stop à la guerre, stop à la guerre. Stop à la guerre, stop à la guerre.
Engaye, 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 mawa. Nalela, nalela, mama, agena. Nalela, nana, nalela, papa, agena. Ma sangue bomeli na papa.
We've been listening to Fally Ipupa with the song Stop à la guerre. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. Please join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mm-hmm. for Nanga.